concerns the recent issues affecting the Idlewild NHS Trust, and I see that Maggie submitted a letter this afternoon. Maggie, would you like to just update us on that, please?
Thanks, John. Yes, there were two items really on the agenda that you wanted us to talk later on. One was our CQC visit in January, which they published a report in early March, and our response to that, which is what I said earlier today. And the second item was around our financial special measures. So if I may begin with the CQC unannounced visit that we had in January, that was a visit which was an unannounced visit. It was part of the CQC's winter-focused inspection regime, where they visited a number of trusts across the country to look at how they were dealing with winter. So I take it that people have read the report. And whilst it was very disappointing for us, I do think, as I said in the response to John, the headlines of these reports are always very stark, and they're always very disappointing. But by far in this report, I'm sure people have read very many positives as well. So, first of all, when the CQC arrived, for context, they do say in the report that the department was very busy on that day. So they acknowledged that they attended when we were under considerable pressure. We had a large volume of patients in the department. They issued us a warning notice, as you'll have seen in the pack, in relation to three areas. One was the fact that we had patients in the corridor, and two, we didn't have a sufficient amount of nurses on duty on that shift, and three, our continued use of agency staff. So if I take you into the first item, which was corridor queue, well, sadly, corridor queues are a reality in most ED departments during winter pressures periods, or throughout the year when you get a large volume of patients that arrive. What was really pleasing in this report that you will have seen in different references that were made to all of those patients that they saw in the queue had been clinically assessed and had observations and were continually monitored throughout the period of time that the CQC were in attendance. And again, for those of you who have been on this journey with us over the last 2 years, you all know that that's progress, because only 12 months ago when they existed in the department, it was in a much more chaotic position than it was. To know that we have to deal with queues at times, that's the reality. You'll have seen on the news, and we've talked about it in this meeting previously. In some EU departments up and down the country, they've now put curtains in their corridor, and they've got call bells in their corridor. But we've done everything we can to avoid that. And I'm really pleased, I think people touched on this when we talk about what we've done, what our action plan is. Since before Christmas, we've had a significant improvement in our ED performance. And in the 11 days preceding the CQC's visit, we had three other visits from NHSI, national and regional colleagues, into our ED department. And whilst they recognised issues such as our recruitment and our current growth from alternating nurses in the setting, the NHSI regional and national teams, and the national team were very ED people, they actually highlighted the progress that we were making. So it was pretty disappointing on the fourth visit, on that 11th day, that they saw us under immense pressure. The second area that they talked to us about was the number of nurses on duty on that day. They actually, in this report, they tell you they only spoke to 8 members of staff throughout the whole day that they were with us. And remember, this visit is focused as one-day inspection, the normal CQC inspection that we're expecting at some point during later in the year. Will be a 3-day inspection where there's an awful lot more balance over the 3-day period as opposed to a snapshot visit of just a few hours. So they spoke to 8 members of staff on duty, and all of the 8 members, they weren't sure by speaking to the 8 members of staff that there were sufficient qualified nurses on duty. So on that shift, there should have been 8 registered nurses, and there were 6. One agency nurse was booked but didn't turn up for the shift. And another member of staff went sick on the day. So into the numbers went our matron, and into the numbers later on when the nurse went sick, our head of nursing went in. So we did feel that we had mitigated against the gaps. However, what let us down was the staff, the other nurses that we spoke to weren't aware that the matron and the head of nursing had gone into the numbers. So it was a busy shift. We did have shortnesses on that day, but there weren't shortnesses that we'd seen coming for a number of weeks or months and not been able to fill. They were actually down to on the day shortages. Now the third area that the CPC have highlighted is that we have got a heavy dependence on agency nursing. And again, that's not a surprise to anybody in this room. We've talked about the shortage of qualified staff frequently when I attend these meetings. We have currently now, we've got circa 150 registered nurse vacancies in the Trust, across the breadth of the Trust. Approximately 80 of them are on the St Mary's site, so in the acute sector of what we do. And we're very pleased, I mentioned to you previously, that we've got 46 nurses joining us in the summer and the autumn from the Philippines, so that will make a big difference to us. Those nurses are all in the acute sector because the model of training in the Philippines is such that we can't easily transfer them to community or our mental health services. So we do have a heavy reliance. As I said here before, there's 33,000 registered nurse vacancies in the country at the moment, and our 150 is our share of that. We have got until the 29th of April to demonstrate a change in those three areas to lift the warning notice. And whilst I feel confident that the work that we're doing around the queue, the corridor flow issues actually, which are what compound the queue, the corridor queue, and in relation to the staffing model in ED, if you remember, we've talked about this here, and I know John particularly will know because we've talked about this at our Trust Board frequently. At the beginning of the year, the financial year last April, we had 1.7 nurse in our ED department. We have been really fortunate, and now we've been able to recruit a further 6, so we have 7.7s. So we do have senior nurse on every shift, able to cover the shifts. The area that we've got the most vacancies is in the Band 5 nurse group, and that's the group that is 33,000 predominant. That's what cohort of nurses make up that large number. I said if some of you have heard me on the radio, and I did both interviews with Solent and Isla White after this report was published. If you are an agency nurse and you've got offered three, and you live on the mainland, and you get offered a shift, three shifts that day, one at Portsmouth, one at Southampton, and one on the Isle of Wight Trust, I can almost predict that the one that you will take won't be the one on the Isle of Wight NHS Trust. Why would you add a ferry journey and an expensive ferry journey as well on top of your expenses for the day? So we're competing in a marketplace where we're not the most attractive employer, and that will make it very difficult for us to be able to completely eradicate some of the gaps that we currently face. We're doing, and both Alice, and I'm not sure all councillors are in that, Alice, yeah. Some of you did when you came for the day. Alice, our new director of nursing, is very involved in the action plan. And the final area, of course, is connected with the skill mix on the day. Until we completely crack those vacancies, we will continue to have skills shortages on certain shifts. We always mitigate them to the best of our abilities. But there will be occasions that when we have gaps in the gap. Really, those are the headlines of what caused the warning notices. But I do think it's worth just drawing your attention again to some of the. If you have read the report, you'll see it's scattered with things that are positive about the improvements that we've made, particularly about the attention to detail and the most critically unwell patients being assessed by medical staff and national best practice guidelines being applied to their care. I think that's something that I'm very pleased to be able to see highlighted in the report. I was also really pleased that we heard in this report that staff spoke positively about working in the ED department, and our medical staff particularly said that they, despite some of the challenges, they were still finding that it was a positive learning experience, and they felt very well supported. It's scattered with positive things as well as the negatives. And I think it's really important for us to hang on to where we were 12 months ago. I think there was something like 23 notices around improvements that we had to apply ourselves to in ED during the last inspection, and that's gone down to the three that I've highlighted to you. So we don't sit on our laurels at all. There is nothing new in what the CPC have told us. All of those areas are part of our action plans. So if I may just pause there, John, and see if there are any questions for you. I am keen that both Alice and Nikki can talk about the impact that Alice drives there from a medical perspective, but particularly because it's related to such strength to nursing. I'm sure there might be something that Alice wants to find about what she's been able to oversee in the two or three months you've been with us now, 2 months.
Thank you, Marie. Any questions? Steve.
Thank you, Carolyn. It just occurred to me that you said that the mainland have an advantage over us with regards to agency staff. I can understand that that's difficult to overcome. Just the thought process, could we have an advantage over the mainland if we were to pay our permanent staff a high level to meet them from the mainland? Does that make sense or not?
You take this nicely into the second point on the agenda, which is our financial special measures. So again, you know, we've talked about, we've had highlights about our finances all year and the deteriorating position that we found ourselves in. In excess of £10 million is what we spent on trying to maintain good quality. And in fact, I use the words very carefully, actually. I would say to you, of the £13 million deterioration we had in our finances this year, it was about patient safety first and then quality. But the vast majority of that has gone into staffing. So we have to operate within the financial constraints available to us, and we have to make our jobs attractive. We are paying an incentive to the nurses that we're bringing from the Philippines, and many of the posts that we are able to fill, we haven't had to pay a recruitment premium to those posts. I think it's important for us to. So, in the 2 years now that I've been here, we've been out to the Philippines once and we've recruited 46 nurses. We go out again to the Philippines in the summer, and we're expected to be able to recruit the same number of nurses again. I think for us, those are key things for us that we can do, and we can do them within an affordability envelope, which I hope puts us on par with other areas of the country. What we need to do, Steve, is work on that retention strategy of the nurses that we've got. So once we've recruited them, we don't lose them in large numbers. I think the other area for us as well is growing our own nurses again. So you know, we've had this, I was really pleased to be able to tell you, the nurse associates, the nurse apprenticeships. This isn't a quick fix, though. It doesn't get to qualified nurses today, tomorrow, in the next year. But over a 3-4 year period, we will be taking nurses, the associates particularly, from an MBQ level up to degree level. And I do believe those are the nurses that will stay, because they are, their families and their networks are all on the island as well. So we've not agreed at a board that will deteriorate our financial position any further by bringing in recruitment and retention premium. We do believe we've got to try harder at doing some of the recruitment that we know is starting to pay off for us. But I don't know, Alice, would you want to add anything to that?
I guess the only thing to say is, particularly around the apprenticeships and the associate nurses, as Maggie's described, we're actually one of the few areas that is oversubscribed with people from the island wanting to come to do it. So I think there's something about skills escalator that we need to have within the organisation, so people can see where they are going and that there is somewhere to go, and more importantly, it's worth staying. And I think that's certainly going to be something we encourage them to do.
Thank you, Maggie and Alice. Sorry, I've got Claire, yeah. Rodney, and Martin.
Can I just add something to that about the question about pay for nurses and stuff like that? I think it's a system we would have to have in discussion as well, because what we have to remember is we need to ensure that we protect the independent sector with nursing homes, And what we don't want to do is make a situation where the independent sector can't afford to employ nurses. If you were going to apply for a job in Ireland, are you going to go to that independent pay? Or if the pay rate is so much higher at the hospital, are you going to go to the hospital? So I think, you know, one of the things that we've been doing as a system is looking at that bigger picture. You know, it's not just the trust. It's if we're going to take people out of, you know, beds, take them to nursing homes, if we haven't got the nurses, that will cause a problem as well. So we need to ensure, and we are making sure that we have those discussions.
Thanks for that question, Steve. Rodney.
Thank you, Chairman. Yeah, I'd just like to ask about the apprenticeship nursing scheme. Does that require the people to go to university? Do you take them to degree level on the job, so to speak? And the other thing what I would like to ask is that when was it required for potential nurses to go to university? Is the reason because they need a lot more skills now, as opposed to when they, you know, they went on, you know, on the nursing job in the hospitals, and they lived in a nurses' home, pretty old-fashioned, as you know. But and people got to be relatable as well to the patients and everything. I don't think it's a complicated question, but thank you, Jeremy.
Okay, I'll try and answer that. So the apprenticeship model and the associate nurse model is absolutely built on them working in practice. So there will be a relationship to university, and there will absolutely be some requirement to do that theoretical study, but it is on-the-job training in inverted commas.
Right.
I guess when did we become a graduate profession? Project 2000 was the first cohort really to look at being degree level nurses, which was back in the 1990s. And we have moved into that same process as our therapists who are all graduates. Obviously, the medical fraternity that we work with are graduates plus, and nursing has changed. The bit for me, though, is the essential care that we deliver, that hands-on care remains the same for all of us, and it is as important to us all as it ever was.
Oh, could I have a supplementary, please? Could I also ask about when there's people who are paid for their tuition fees in university, did that affect the numbers of people coming forward to study nursing? Thank you.
You would be right to say there has been a reduction since the bursary was removed. How that pans out in the longer term, because we haven't seen that full 3 years, and there was a huge attrition rate from the numbers of people going into nursing as opposed to the number of people finishing their nursing degrees. So I think we still need to look at that, and that's possibly where some of the apprenticeship models are coming in. But there has been a reduction in the numbers of people going forward for nursing places.
Thank you.
Just to say maybe that it's slightly similarities to the work we're doing around GP recruitment. And so there are a number of things that we can't do. So there is an agreement across the STP, but also across many parts of the NHS now, not to offer financial incentives because everybody poaches from the same pool. So the national context is that there are some shortages, not just of nurses, but of every profession that we have to recruit to. So I think it's a sensible position that, you know, we don't take people from one part of the system and put them into another, but that presents us with our challenges, and I'm almost hastening to sort of delve into the transport issue. But what we are looking at doing around GP recruitment is what can we do to within the rules that doesn't break those principles of offering incentives that just shifts the problem around the system to reflect the fact that there are some additional costs involved on the island. So for GP recruitment, we are offering some support to actually help people come to the island, both for their travel but also with some housing. So I think it's part of a broader conversation that we need to have around the island, which is even if we found another £30 million for the hospital tomorrow, it's not going to solve the problem around recruitment. So I think we're going to have to start thinking a little bit more laterally around how do we augment the workforce. And we've had apprentices and we've had a whole lot of new grades, but the fact is the problems that we have are actually presented in a series of policy papers being considered at national level because everybody recognises that this problem is going to get worse rather than better. So maybe as we get into the one public solution for the island, there's further
conversations we need to have around how do we grow our own, what do we do, how do we use technology to augment, because that problem isn't going to go away anytime soon.
Thank you. Mike.
Sorry. I've got three questions. I think going from what you just said, Martin and Maggie, there is this island factor. And I think that the Otterwhite Council, is through work done by Portsmouth University, clarified that cost of that factor. It'd be really good if we could actually get a whole island cost and factor, because I think it's important to continue, whether it's through our MP and through the Otterwhite Council, saying to ministers, actually, it costs us that piece of water. I think the more that we communicate that, perhaps a message might eventually get through. Because I actually think there is this other factor that we do need to resolve. So my first question is, your view, you know, can we get with the university, same with Portsmouth, so we can actually calculate clearly how much it costs us different from Southampton and Portsmouth? We never had that specific figure. We've got the 6.5 figure on our council. But it would be good if we could actually have the actual figure of that.
So the work we've been doing around how we make the services more sustainable both clinically and financially, in the first instance, seems to indicate that sum is between 10 and 15 million. So that's the additional cost of providing services on the island, which is over and above that compared to other services of a similar population. There's more work needs to be done on that, because we will get to increasing levels of refinement, but if we take it that that's the type of level, it might be 12, it might be 9, is that what it might be?
Is there also an additional cost through the economies of scale? I mean, we're quite a small hospital, we're a general hospital, so I would imagine that in many departments we're subscale, and that has a cost. Sorry, I looked that in.
And we've had those conversations here before. You know, I think I've used maternity services as an example. To financially be viable service, we have to see a minimum of 3,000 births a year. That's just on the way that the national tariffs paid for us to be able to hold our own on financially on that service. But of course, you know, we don't do 3,000 births a year. We're lucky to do 1,200 births a year. So there are a number of our services, which we've talked about before, which are subscale, which give us a problem not only from a financial perspective, but also from a clinical sustainability. You know, we've talked before about, you know, if we've got such a small service that we only see 1 in 10,000 population with that illness, we have to have a way of making sure that when you do see someone, you see someone who's contemporary and understands the nature of the illness that they're dealing with. So not only is it financial challenge to subscale, but it gives us a big clinical challenge as well. And that really takes you into what those sustainability plans are that we've been working as a system to start to develop. So how can we make our services fit for the future, but financially able to hold their own as well? But all of that are challenges that aren't new to us.
Thank you for that, Maggie and Martin. Michael.
Yes, I mean, we're basically coming up to about figure 21.5 million if you take the other way, sort of figure together, but there is that difference. On the vision, I'm reading the report. I wish to thank you, because one of the things is, yes, you see the bottom line, and yes, you're in the special measures within that. But if you read through this report, it does actually talk about cultural change. I mean, if you look at the previous reports, where you had a very demoralised workforce, this sudden come in didn't actually pick that up. It actually picked it up that it was actually changing. And I think we do need to celebrate that. You've been here for 2 years, Maggie, right? You were brought in to transform because of your skills of what you did in Staffordshire. What's your vision now? Where do you think there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel, right? Because if anybody's going to do it, I think it's going to be you, right? What is, when are we going to come to this meeting where we're actually going to say, actually, we can start to see the light within that? And what do you need from us to support that movement?
And keep me accountable as well, Michael. I do appreciate them. I think one of the things I've said to you consistently, and it was the same message in Stafford, was you can't change culture overnight. It takes time. And this report was really pleasing to me personally, but also to the team, because it's starting to say, for example, the line around all patients were assessed. The critically ill patients were being managed appropriately. You achieve things like that when you've got motivated staff who feel valued and feel that it's a decent place to work again. So this report is the first one I've seen, and I've read very closely the 2014 and the 2016 reports. So it's the first one that shows us that the culture work that we're doing in this department has started to have an impact. But the other question you said to me about, you know, when will we start to see more successes, is one that I find really frustrating, because I can't. It's the CQC that needs to come in and validate some of the changes that we've made. And bursting at the seams is prior to some of the changes we've made in our ambulance service and our community services. And I really hope that when the CQC come in and we're able to sit here, I believe our children's and up to 19 services now is good, and you know, I'd like to see that they're outstanding, but I know that they are so much improved from where they were when the CQC last came in. Our end of life care, for example, that's significantly improved. So we have made improvements, but until the CQC come back and do their assessments, you're just listening to me and my team. We work with NHSI, so we do have external senior NHS people that come and do some of the visits with us. But the real benchmark will be when the CQC comes back. And whilst I make the trepidation, because there's areas where we've done really well, and there will be other areas where we've still got issues, like the highlighted on the one-day visit to ED. So we're expecting, we have what we call a pre-inspection request for information document, but it's very comprehensive, and we completed that during March. We know that there's usually about 16 weeks after that information's been uploaded to the CQC that we get the visits, and of course they're unannounced. So we're expecting sometime in the early summer that we see the CQC back, and all our hard efforts are going into being able to really demonstrate the successes that we've had across the board, but particularly in the areas where we know we should be showcasing. So that's the, you know, the most appropriate answer I can give you to that.
My last question briefly is the Googly, is the sort of the serious case review, the mistake, whilst you're coming up, there's that vulnerability in anything that's coming through transformation, that, you know, the one night a, you know, serious incident has happened, and that actually then can, you know, be huge in compensation claims, be huge for years of a serious, you know, case review. It can take over a year to get a coroner's report and all that side. And that is a particular polaris which actually happens, you know, within the NHS with the adult social care system. What's your inside track? Is there improvement in the sense of, is there a reduction in those cases you just said about the critical, you know, if people are being properly assessed in the critically ill, that is going to make more safeguarding, as it were, risk management against something tragic happening. Well, how's that going? Because you only need to get the three buses of tragedy, that can actually just create a complete logjam, can't it?
So I'm going to ask Alison and Rowan to comment on that as well, Michael. I think what I would like to say is, first of all, in relation, you're right, in some of the cases that the coroner has been very vocal about recently, or over a year old, or a year or older. And as I said last week when I attended court, it's really very disappointing. And I share her frustrations, but some of the incidents that she's talking about are from a year ago. And our quality assurance and our processes, you know, I think I've mentioned to the coroner last week that when the CQC came in January 2018, the report got published in February, I believe, the CQC said they liked the changes that I was introducing, but we were starting from a very low base. Now, that very low base, I don't say to defenders, I say because fundamentally that was all about governance, as you know, and of governance, SI process is really a pivotal part of that. So it was very broken. We appointed our Director of Quality Governance, who started on 1st of February last year. Alistair only joined us in June, and before that it did feel like a one-man show account. So we've rebuilt that process, but unfortunately the coroner has not yet started to see the incidents that have now come through the new process. And until she sees a tipping balance in that, then she will continue to be frustrated. Because I can't rewrite history, as I mentioned to her last week. But one of the most important indicators for us, and we should never forget this, and perhaps we haven't talked about this enough together, is hospital standardised mortality. So how many people, how do we learn from deaths? So we've got a hospital standardised mortality of, I think, 78 at the moment. And our Shilling, which is another key indicator, is, I think, 101. And that is an improving position for us. So the amount of people that die within our trust compared to our demographic benchmarks extremely well, or if not better, than many other parts of England. So we know that the way that we care for the most critically ill patient is not seeing a spike in death, unnecessary deaths, which I think it was a vital indicator in Stafford, and it's certainly a vital one for us. So we are learning a lot from the reviews that we do, and I'll ask Alistair just to give them a flavour of the case reviews and the work that we're doing there, please.
From the emergency department point of view, it's had a very good record on serious incidents specifically for that department in recent months. Now, we need to remind ourselves what serious incidents investigation is all about. It's all about learning from the events that take place. They are not a process to sort of feed the compensation litigation process. It's actually to develop our own workforce to learn from those events that have happened in any particular serious incident, because there are a range of particular criteria that warrant that definition. Undoubtedly, since I've been there since June, the capability and ability for us to actually undertake serious incident investigations has increased considerably. The professionalism, the abilities of individuals to do it, to do a fair and unbiased investigation, is critically important for it to be a value for the individuals who are affected or being involved with the case, because doctors and nurses can feel extremely vulnerable when there's been investigation into their practice. So we do have to have a process that is really well balanced and supportive in terms of bearing out the true facts of what's taking place, and then consequently getting the learning from those events. So I think it's really important to demonstrate our ability collectively within the community to understand what the purpose of them are. And if we do have them, we've had a tendency probably to over-report serious incidents, so in other organisations they wouldn't have that sort of level of the bar would be a bit lower, which in a sense is a good thing. It does actually create a lot of work because they're very in-depth processes. So my view is that we're still on the journey. We're still developing that capability. When there is a serious incident where it would be inappropriate to be investigated internally, we're very very quick to identify somebody from another organisation to do that investigation, so there's no conflict of interest, and particularly with regard to patients and those who've been affected, the individuals. We're going to be including them more and more in the process, so that we hopefully avoid sometimes the distress that serious incident investigations have subsequently, and that could be in the coroner's court.
Thank you. John? Sorry,
it's just me to add from making the structure around SIs. The Trust has been really proactive as well in terms of the Safe Home Adults Board. One of the things which we're going to be doing there is, as part of the quality and performance reports that come through to every SAB meeting, is an overview of those SIs. And it's not about in any way interrogating the SI investigations on an individual basis. What it is, it's about looking at any themes which are coming through, and I would hope that would provide additional assurance to this committee.
Thank you. John.
Thanks, Chairman. I think mine is really quite simple. It's not as complicated as everybody else's. It's just that it seems to me that the criticism of an inspector is not the quality of staff, but the quantity of staff. You know, in other words, that there's supposed to be 8 on and there's only 6 on. I mean, I'm not blaming you, Maggie, you're doing your best, but what can we do to improve this? It's all the way through this summary of saying people weren't there during certain times, when they were coming in, there was no one to do the triage, etc., etc. You know, I'm just a bit concerned that all of a sudden something goes wrong. An assistant does the checking and makes a mistake, and then all hell breaks loose because, somebody dies and then it's a problem. So what can we do? I mean, do you know roughly, like on the wards and that, percentages of the staff you should have on against how many you do have on, and are you able to record that, give us some idea of figures, so that we can see the problem you've got? Because I'm not here to blame you, because you're struggling with this the same as everybody else, but it just seems that we need to do something to make sure that we've got the number of staff. Because I've got every faith on the staff you've got to do a good job.
Thank you, John. Maggie?
Thank you. And Alex is going to comment on some of the work that we do, but where we look at the numbers of nurses on every ward or on every shift every second. But I do want to just lay the point that you've just made as well, John. 12 months ago and 2 years ago, when the CQC visited, they didn't just criticise us for the numbers of nurses on shift, they criticised us for some of the gaps, particularly from a culture perspective, but also from things like mandatory training and appraisals, and we know that those numbers are considerably improved upon. So we are making progress, and I keep saying to our staff, despite what the CQC said about those 3 prominent areas, we have to build on everything that we've been doing. We don't allow this to derail us and go back to Michael's point about what can you do to support us. If you believe that our plans are the right plans, then please carry on supporting us in the way that you have been doing. Challenges, by all means, the session that we had when you came into the Trust, they're extremely valuable for all of the directors. So if you believe that our plans are the right ones, continue to support us. But I'll ask Alice, the main point of what you're saying is, how do we manage to mitigate? And as I say, on that day, we did mitigate, so they still had their 8 nurses, but sadly, the nurses in the department didn't know that. So when they were asked how many nurses are on duty, they said 6 and we should have 8, because they didn't realise that those 2 nurses, the matron and the head of nursing, had dropped into the numbers. So we've got to get better at the way we communicate with our staff. We've done a number of things since the visit. So when they know there's a shortage, the staff on duty who are very busy haven't got time to go and ask everybody what's happening, we have to have a way of making them aware of what are we doing to plug some of those gaps. But I just want to talk about this.
Thank you. So we do twice yearly establishment reviews. So that's how everyone knows what measures they should have. And we look at the the acuity and dependency of patients versus the number of registered nurses and unregistered nurses we have in each particular area. We only do it currently for nursing teams. We're looking at doing it for therapists and other professions. But I guess on a daily basis, they are rostered, and we know how many people we've rostered onto that shift, and we will, the ward staff know how many people should be there, Amy will know how many people should be in the department. If we fall below those numbers, what we'll do is look at the acuity and dependency of patients that we've got within there. Do we need extra staff, and then how do we manage that movement? Twice a day, so morning and later afternoon, we look at the numbers of staff we've got, the numbers of staff who may be phoned in sick, work out whether our areas are clinically safe, and every area is informed of that. Clearly, you manage your staff and families, we put everybody into place, and then somebody goes off sick mid-shift. Again, we have an escalation for that, so that we have somebody on duty 24 hours a day that they can refer to, and we can either move staff around or work out how we're going to mitigate it. We do use bank relations and temporary workforce, and we do absolutely ensure that everybody, certainly in the early department, there is a board now that clearly identifies how many people should be in the department and where we move people from to. So hopefully everything is completed by annual.
And if I may as well, I think what I would like to just point out, especially because I don't want to cause any alarm necessarily in our population, of those 150 nursing vacancies that I mentioned earlier, we have a very good fill rate with our banking agency. I've seen some figures last week that showed 98% of the shifts were covered. So I don't want people thinking that, gosh, we've got 150 vacancies all the time. The biggest cause of our financial deficit has been that we've been safely filling those gaps, but with very expensive agency nurses. So we on the ground floor at any one time, we do have predominantly the right numbers of staff. However, as this report pointed out, when you rely on some of those nurses, in it, I would like to also say, some of the agency nurses who've worked in our trust have worked there longer than I have. So they are familiar with our systems and processes, and they choose to work as agency, and we have very long lines of agency nurses. So we would be lost without them, but they're not all new people every shift, although there is an element of that across the trust. But it's not as good in a team when you don't know how long that agency nurse is going to be with you as it is when you've got your own team present.
Right,
we've
got Martin and
Nicky. Chairman, can I just one thing on that? How many nurses do you reckon, when they're off sick or off with stress, do you actually split it up?
Yeah, we monitor all of that, John, and we know that across the whole of the trust, that work-related stress remains high. But not just for us, sadly, on the Isle of Wight. We were having a conversation about the National Staff Survey recently, and sadly, across the breadth of the NHS, work-related stress is something that we've all got to take really seriously, because it's affecting our people on Ireland, and it also affects the NHS in general.
Thank you for that.
Thank you. Right, Martin.
Thanks, Chair. So it's a system collective responsibility to sort out these issues, not just the hospital. And whilst I think the system has been working much more effectively, so we've had lots of input from social services and from the CCD to try to make whatever contributions we can to sorting this problem out. Roughly 40% of patients who attend the OE department have minor illnesses, and that's because that they go there for a variety of reasons. So there is investment in primary care, there's been investment in social services through some of the things that have been done. But the paper D, I hope, starts to then capture some of the additional activities that the trust and primary care GPs are working on, which actually recognises that by diverting some of those patients out of a very busy ED department into a different service, actually will take away some of the pressure. Because this notice relates to crowding and are there enough people. The crowding thing that I think we can start to resolve, because we can take away some of those patients at peak times and look after them in an alternative setting. The staff, again, is how do we support that with primary care staff and others. And the work that has been going on, and I hope reading Dr. Salter and Jonathan will be able to share with you, there's some really positive stuff that has been done in the department, which I hope next year will still be in the old episode, but it won't be as frequent as it has been now. And then the work that we've been doing with social services about increasing capacity for patients at the hospital will make some of those things slightly easier to deal with. But I didn't want it to be that this is just the hospital's issue to sort out. It's the whole of the health and social care system's responsibility to do that. And we just need to, we are getting better at it, but I'm hoping that this time next year there'll be a different conversation where we've been able to deliver more services in a different sector.
Thank you, Martin. Thank you. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I suppose the final points we need to be. We've talked here about the winter plan, we brought it here. We knew we would have beds that we would flex up in the winter. We knew that there was extra schemes at social care and CCG colleagues have supported through primary care. We've not yet brought back to you the model of how we did go into, but we will, and we'll do some of the current regulations, because there has been periods this winter when we've not been able to access all the beds that have been available to us in the community for a variety of reasons. We've talked here before about restrictions that are on some of our nursing homes due to their own CQC reports. And of course, for every bed that we can't access, that means that we're faced with not only, as Martin said, about 40% of patients that attend RED, but we also know we've got a lot of patients all of the time who are medically discharged, and it's a whole industry of both Carol's team and our team of trying to find the most appropriate setting for those patients. But the final point I want to leave you with as well around, we invested £1.5 million into our staffing model in ED this last financial year, and at the end of March. We've still not been able to remove all of the people into those posts, but it's a much more improved position. If you think of how long we tried previously to recruit those about 7 nurses that I mentioned before, we've now got the full complement. Those nurses as well, and that went from our community hear that we've got the supervision now from those senior nurses, we're highly optimistic that will help us with some of the five points. And of course, you know, because you've seen some of the improvements we made in the environment, we invested £1.3 million last year into those environmental change to help with the congestion. And we're about to spend another portion of money, I think, anywhere between 250 and 400k on further improvements to the ED department, particularly from a paediatric access perspective. So we have got a plan and we're following it, and I hope that you do take some comfort from some of the many positives that are in the report, and you're sure that we will continue to work on the 3 predominant areas that were highlighted on this inspection. We expected to be able to put evidence in by April the 29th to get those warning notices lifted. And of course, John will hear this at our trust board, and then we'll bring it back here to the appropriate overview and scrutiny of the progress we're making.
Thank you, Maggie.
Just wanted to build on Alice's point to pronounce on you. It's a very busy environment. One of the things, if you walked in there today, that you'd notice different is you can easily identify the nurse in charge, the doctor in charge, any changes that happen during the day, there's a whiteboard. So clearly, staff that wander in and out can actually see who is doing what and where. They huddle together, they look at issues. It's a very rapidly changing environment, and they are really, really keen to actually build on some of the things that we've identified before. So those are just some of the small things if you practically walked in there. Also, just to say, as Martin had mentioned around the fact that we are moving patients into right place with right time. Minors have started to move, we're going to bring the urgent care service together with them. And during this week, you've heard us talk in the past around having ambulatory care in our medical assessment units. We have that opening with in combination with our surgical assessment service as well. So that has been real and changing as we speak. So lots going on, and like I said, a lot of investment as well.
Thank you. Michael, did you want to make one question?
I just wanted to make a quick comment, really. It's very sad about this agency issue. The reality is if people work in the agencies, they're in permanent jobs. We might, it's not just in the NHS and social work, etc. It's just that we're in a society where people can actually get a higher salary, in fact, double the salary through the agencies, and also the agency as a private company makes, you know, a huge profit from it. And it's a very sad point that we're actually in that situation with agencies. We have people who work a long time in an organisation with their colleagues, but because they're an agency, they're able to cash in more. And it doesn't get discussed enough, and perhaps we need to eventually have legislation to actually tackle it.
Thank you, Michael. Well, I think with what's been said, that I think we can agree that we've had plenty of reassurance. In fact, we've had context, and particularly with the financial situation, and it's hardly surprising that you're in the red when we learn how much it costs to operate, not just because we're an island, but because of the subscale issue. Is there, and I would guess, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, that there might be some benefit from the financial special measures, because at least NHSI will actually see the hardship that you're having to work under.
Thank you, and that takes me nicely into the second point we wanted to discuss. So I think we worked hard last year with NHSI to prevent ourselves going into financial special measures. And myself and Vaughan have reflected an awful lot about whether that's the right thing for us to do. John, you've heard us discuss in the Trust Board on numerous occasions. And what we were most fearful of was what that would do to our reputation and to, you know, when we're out there trying to recruit staff, not only have we got quality special measures, but we've got financial special measures. Staff appreciate, you know, I know I'm not saying anything that you're not citing on, because you've been here a lot longer than I have, but many of our staff would say to you, and I'm sure you have when you walk around, that some of the problems we've got are because we've made poor financial decisions over the last decade. So we took out services because we thought, instead of having a solution to some of the subscale issues, if we just try and save a little bit of money over here and save a little bit of money over there, then that will help. And actually all that's done is really undermine the quality of the services that we're able to provide. So our staff are very nervous and about the financial special measures, and will it mean a crude attack on what we do and all of the improvements that we've started. So we tried very hard last year to prevent that happening, and sadly we've been unable to really stop it. And I do believe that the predominant reason for that is underpinned by our vacancies and the skill mix that's been available to us. So of the £13 million where we've deviated, the vast majority of that is about staffing and the models of care that we've now put back into the trust. And the most significant part of the deficit all relates to staffing. And I'm reading the table here that was prepared for me earlier today, which I'm happy after the meeting to share with John, that you can be circulated. But outside of staffing, we've got issues like we've improved the access to diagnostic tests. So all of you who've been on our site will have noticed at the front we've had the mobile MR scanner. And we've made that investment because we believed it was the right thing to do from a safety perspective to be able to improve our diagnostic imaging. We've introduced our new CAD system, the new computer-aided dispatch, which is making a significant difference to our ability to attend to Category 1 patients, particularly life-threatening patients in our community where they call 999. And we've also responded to some growth in our contract as well. So we've seen patients attend for treatments that we've had to put staffing in appropriately to accommodate. And the other area that's been two areas that have contributed to the deficit. One was we've not closed the books yet, have we? We've been a few days before the end of March. But it's likely that we won't achieve the full £8 million SIP programme that we set our stall on, but we will have achieved 6.9, maybe we'll get to 7 million by the time we close our books. And again, whilst that's a sad story because we were aiming for 8,
you know that that's the biggest amount of SIP that this trust has ever achieved, £6.9 million, significantly more than it's ever been able to do before. So I don't want to lose track of the fact that we've brought in a methodology for helping people manage their money better. We've been absolutely rigorous in changing some of our practices to reflect national best practice. And the other thing that we've done is we've invested this year to save in subsequent years to the tune of about £1 million as well. So some of you will remember that we introduced a mutually agreeable redundancy scheme earlier in the year, and we let a number of our staff who felt that were in historic types of roles that weren't really serving as a purpose going forward. And we knew that it would cost us in a year, but we'll get the benefits over the next couple of years. As we see those people depart. So there's nothing hidden. John comes to all of our trust boards. We have frequent discussions on the finance, and we've talked to you here as the year's gone on, and we particularly have conversations about CCG about that. So I'm very disappointed, but as we've discussed, we're using ED as an example. I said to you we put £1.5 million into our ED. Well, across the whole of our emergency floor, that has equaled actually £3.1 million because we've got other emergency problems where we had to increase the number of staff. So by far it's been about bringing the right level of people into the trust, although a lot of this spend in this financial year has not been the permanent people, as we've just spent some considerable time discussing. It's been the fact that some of those have been at premium cost through agency allotments.
Thank you for the in-depth explanation and reassurance on that matter as well. Right, we'll move on to item number